You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk about whether Wisconsin could become a new hub for the gaming and technology industry.
First, the United States Supreme Court is playing a role in the upcoming presidential election. In February, Justice Antonin Scalia died, leaving a vacancy on the court that will probably persist until after the November election. President Barack Obama announced a nominee in March, but Senate Republicans have declined to consider him.
Pundits think elderly justices could retire, which means the next president would pick two or more new judges. The court is currently made up of four liberals and four conservatives, and the new justice could shift the court in either direction.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump recently brought the open Supreme Court seat up in a speech in North Carolina about the Second Amendment.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick... If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
Barbara Perry joins us now to talk about how the vacancy on the court is playing into the presidential election. She's a professor of ethics and institutions and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Rob and Veronica.
Well, let's start with those comments from Donald Trump. I mean, the Supreme Court appointments have come up a lot. This was probably the most prominent example because of the backlash, the reaction that one got.
Yes, I would say so. I've been following this issue about the Supreme Court and presidential campaigns for about 30 years, and if indeed one believes that Donald Trump was going down the assassination road, one never knows perhaps with him, but obviously some people took it that way. I can't recall another time when a candidate brought up the Supreme Court and then said, yes, it's a problem. If my opponent wins, he or she will get to appoint people to the Supreme Court, and there's nothing you can do about it, meaning there's no way to remove a justice except through impeachment and conviction, and then therefore we should assassinate my opponent. So I make light almost to keep from crying, but again, perhaps he didn't mean that, and I know that he tried to indicate that that's not what he meant. But it's a very rare instance of incendiary language about the Supreme Court and the opponent in this instance.
Turning to the wider issue, the Supreme Court appointment, though, it seems like I'm hearing a lot of arguments, Democrats saying, hey, Bernie Sanders supporters, even if you don't like anything else Hillary Clinton's doing, Supreme Court, you got to vote for her. And then the Never Trump movement, they're being told, well, you don't like Donald Trump, but you want Hillary Clinton appointing Supreme Court justices. Have you ever seen the issue of Supreme Court appointments being this front and center in a presidential race?
Yes, and in fact, there has been. Oftentimes, though, this is sort of the last resort, but a last resort this time around is more likely because the favorability, or should I say unfavorability ratings of these two candidates is so high. So it is the case then that I think as a last resort on both sides, people are saying, well, you may not like this candidate, but think of the Supreme Court. But this is certainly not the first time that the court has played a large, large role, front and center in some cases, in our elections. And we can go back, for example, in 1936, although FDR was about to try to implement his court packing plan, which he would do after his landslide victory in 1936 into 1937, and he didn't really bring up the court that much on the campaign trail. It was always in the background because the court kept striking down his New Deal legislation that Congress had passed through. So it really did become front and center in American politics. 1968, Richard Nixon, because of the liberal Earl Warren Court, Earl Warren, of course, was Chief Justice from the 50s through the 60s, and had indicated that he was going to step down. The Republicans and Southern Democrats had filibustered Abe Fortas, who was the choice to replace him by Lyndon Johnson, so Earl Warren had to stay on in that position. So it was really clear in 1968 in that election that the changes were coming from the actual Chief Justice chair on down through the ranks of the associates. So Richard Nixon had an actual strategy, a Southern strategy, he called it, to try to really bring people on board who hated the Warren Court. I can remember as a kid seeing impeach Earl Warren signs and bumper stickers around the country. So that was another example. And then in the 80s, in 84 and 88, because we have a situation now that we had then, they call it the grain of the court. As the court ages, it obviously the actuarial imperative is such that there could be more seats open up, as did, sadly, with Justice Scalia this past February.
Talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at Supreme Court politics in the presidential race. Barbara, one thing that seems a little less precedented, I guess, is there's a vacancy. There is a job opening on the Supreme Court. It's not being filled, and we've got candidates running, and we know, unless something happens, we can talk about that, unless something happens after the election in the lame duck Senate, they've got an appointment to make on day one.
Yes, this is highly unusual. In fact, I racked my brain over the weekend trying to think of times, at least in modern history, when this had happened. I had to go all the way back to 1956, so back 60 years. And in fact, this one was so fascinating because a justice, an associate justice, Sherman Minton, suddenly left in ill health in October of 1956, just a few weeks before the election. And the incumbent president, Eisenhower, who was running for re-election, of course, took a very interesting approach, and he made a recess appointment of Bill Brennan, William Brennan, to the court, which was then approved when the new Senate came back in the January of 1957. But that was the last time. But it was so close to the election, it almost didn't have an impact on it because people weren't thinking in those terms, where now people have had since February to be thinking about this open seat on the court.
Now, Barbara, to enrich my civics education here, you mentioned the phrase impeach Earl Warren. I am dimly aware that a Supreme Court justice could be impeached. What has to happen to make that happen?
Right. So that's the only way to remove a justice short of his or her own retirement or the Grim Reaper. And it is the same process for removing a president. So if people remember back to the impeachment hearings for both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton, so it starts in the House. The House acts as sort of a grand jury. If they wish to go forward with articles of impeachment, that's like an indictment. Then it goes to the Senate, and the Senate acts as the trial court, if you will. Interestingly enough, with the Chief Justice presiding, if it is the president whose impeachment is on the line. So that is the way and the only way to remove any member of the federal judiciary, from U.S. District Court to Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court.
Is this something we do very often?
Not very often at all. I think the figure is about 16 lower federal court judges have been removed in our 240 years, so that's district court and court of appeals. And if I'm remembering correctly, back in the just after the founding era, Justice Chase, was impeached, but if I'm recalling my history correctly, was not convicted and therefore not removed from office. But it was certainly a shot across the bow of the court, to be sure.
Demographics have changed in the United States. People have longer life expectancies. Those people include Supreme Court justices. Is the sheer fact that we expect people to live and be productive longer, does that put more at stake on any individual appointment? If you appoint a 40-something court justice, they may be making critical decisions for 30, 40 years?
Absolutely, indeed, Rob. But I think about Justice Scalia, you know, passing away in February. He was about to mark 30 years on the bench because he had been appointed in his 50s by Ronald Reagan, who is long gone from this mortal coil. And here he was still on the bench, someone going back into our history like Chief Justice John Marshall, a Federalist appointed by John Adams in 1801, serves on the court until the 1830s. The Federalist Party doesn't even exist when he dies. So it is the case, and some presidents, particularly Ronald Reagan, fought very hard and long about wanting to put on younger members, people like Scalia in their 50s, knowing that they could, if they have good health, they could serve into their 80s, they could serve 30, 40, maybe even 50 years. The court right now has an average age of 71, but I should point out that Supreme Court justices rival only symphony orchestra conductors in terms of their longevity.
How big a role do you think Supreme Court appointments, this vacancy, maybe more to come, are going to play between now and November's voting day?
I think that it'll probably be a tertiary role. I don't think it'll be a primary role as it was, I would say, in those examples I've given of 1968, for example. So for some people, it may be a primary issue, but for probably most people, a secondary or a tertiary issue. But I say it may be this time around, ironically, because these two candidates have such high favorability ratings and are not viewed as trustworthy. Maybe the case that people say, well, I'm going to pick one over the other, and I'm going to solely base it on what kinds of people they would put on the Supreme Court.
Barbara, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Rob.
That's Barbara Perry, Professor of Ethics and Institutions and Director of Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. She joined us to talk about how the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court is affecting presidential election politics.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
and I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the perspective of a resident of the neighborhood in Milwaukee where violence erupted this weekend after police shot a man after a traffic stop.
First, the gaming and technology industry has long seen the West Coast as its hub, but it could also have a home in Wisconsin. Madison has seen the rise of a budding technology scene, and for now, UW-Madison is home to the Games, Learning, and Society Center.
The center has brought in millions in grants from the federal government and private foundations and has staff that's also employed in private sector gaming jobs. Its research has explored using games to enhance learning on everything from empathy and civic activism to literacy and programming.
But this year, the center's co-directors, Professors Kurt Squire and Constance Steinkuhler, are leaving the UW for the University of California, Irvine. Leaving those left behind wondering what it might mean for the future of gaming in Wisconsin and for UW-Madison's efforts to retain faculty. Kurt Squire joins us now. In addition to being co-director of the Games Learning and Society Center, he's a professor of digital media and curriculum instruction at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when you and Constance Steinkuhler founded the Games and Learning and Society Center, how well established was the study of gaming in mainstream academics?
Not at all. It was a lot of people looked at us like we were kind of crazy. And so part of our idea initially was just to bring together game developers, teachers, technologists to really look at what the future of this medium would be and then what it would mean for learning and for schools and how we interact.
And so over the years, that was the beginning, has that changed? Are people starting to look at you a little bit differently, those that thought you were a little bit crazy?
Oh, definitely. It's funny. There's a current generation of students who has no idea that this was seen as weird when they came up. One of the things that's really exciting is that we do have probably 50 or 60 people employed in Madison building games of this sort. So there's Filament Games, some other startups. The Learning Games Network has an office here. So we are really building games that are played throughout the world to help people learn stuff.
So making sure that we're all on the same page, how would you describe the scope of what you do with games at UW-Madison, and I guess taking that with you to UC Irvine?
Yeah, so we like to do everything from basic research on what are kids learning through playing. So what are kids learning as they're playing Minecraft, and are there opportunities for using a game like that to learn academic areas, all the way over to designing games in science and in social studies and other academic areas. What we'll be doing, we will be physically leaving, and some of our research initiatives will. But folks like Filament Games will still be here, folks like the Learning Games Network. So hopefully there will still be a robust games and learning scene. And the games, I should also say, the commercial entertainment game scene will remain, you know, pretty much unaffected, I think.
And so if you were to look maybe 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road, what kind of potential do you see both academics and, you know, looking at private sector and education, all of that? What kind of potential do you see for this field?
Well, there's a lot of potential. I think as the success of Pokemon Go has shown a lot of people, there are a lot of ways that augmented reality kinds of technologies can get kids learning outside, you know, getting outside the classroom for science, for architecture, history. That's something we've actually been pioneers in here in Madison. So the Field Day Project, which is led by David Gagnon, which will still be sticking around, they've been working with teachers across the state with the support from DPI, which is a really exciting project. All the way over to VR, I think you're going to see a lot of new and interesting kinds of VR technologies develop. So we're really just getting started, and I think that in the next 5 or 10 years, it will be some really dramatic shifts in how people learn.
And addressing some of the concerns maybe that people may have initially about gaming and what you're doing with it, how do you describe the potential that you might see the study has for the development of revenue and for jobs, job creation?
Yeah, I think one of the really big opportunities here is that, so we have the kind of commercial games industry that, you know, is quite global, and there are folks here in Madison, both independent games and AAA designers, building games that are played throughout the world. But I think there's a interesting opportunity for universities like Wisconsin to have games that are built coming out of the science out of their labs. So we've been working with Richie Davidson for a couple of years building games and other apps for improving empathy, for improving social empathy. I think you also see similar stuff in the sciences happen. And Madison's really uniquely positioned, having such a great research university, to partner with some of these local companies and get out some of the ideas that faculty have, getting them out to the public through these kinds of avenues.
So we've been talking about this potential, And you and Constance Steinkuller have been pretty instrumental to that over these last several years. She was President Obama's video game czar, I know, for a couple years.
Yep.
You've brought in millions of dollars in grants. So what happens now that you're leaving? What do you tell people who are remaining in the scene in Madison who want to see it grow? Is this maybe... hard for you to talk about, to assess
yeah.
your own worth, but what do you think happens next?
It is hard, and there's so many great people here, from teachers to partners, like I said, at DPI. My hope, though, is that there will be maybe another generation will come up and start to pick up some of where we left off. One reason that we're holding our GLS conference this week together with Forward Fest. So something we're hoping is that another group of people, teachers, maybe some of the other faculty in, say, math education, might step up and start to have some events along with Forward Fest so they can kind of pick up where we left off. But yeah, there are some really great people here. Filament Games is still sticking around, and the game scene is really starting to thrive. So my hope is that maybe a next generation can, again, pick up where we left off and keep it going.
So you see Madison as still being a place that has some potential to move forward. Someone steps in and this movement keeps growing, as you see it.
I think so. I do think one thing that is going to be a challenge for folks at the university is that this kind of work, where you're going to, say, prioritize working with the community members, with teachers, with companies, isn't something that's historically as valued at Wisconsin, I think, as some other places. So, we are a pretty traditional university where you do research and you write grants maybe to support that research. But I think one thing, we'll see if it happens, but to really have these kinds of partnerships, it has to be valued alongside those other activities and is seen as something that is really contributing to the university. I think hopefully it will, because it brings jobs to the state and really helps the stay a vibrant community.
We're talking with Kurt Squire right now from UW-Madison. He's one of the founders of the Games and Learning and Society Center. And he is planning to leave for the University of California, Irvine, I think mid-year. Mm-hmm. That's slated to happen. So I want to ask you about that now, pivoting to why you're leaving. What made you decide to do that?
Oh, it's hard to talk about. So we both really do love Wisconsin. There were a lot of reasons. One of the biggest ones is just the political climate here between the university and the state has gotten to the point where it is pretty difficult to get some things done for us. You're having historic budget cuts, you're having changes to faculty governance, the weakening of the tenure, all of those things happening at once also means that it's kind of hard to go and start innovating and doing new things when everyone's starting to feel retrenched. And I'll say that, sadly, when you go to other places, you can, and you look back at Wisconsin, there's kind of this dark cloud around the university. And for us, that was one of the big factors. There were some other kind of places, where we were in our own careers that made it an okay time to go.
And you're joining the ranks of other high-profile faculty members who have decided to leave and who have gone public with some of their concerns, sometimes their frustrations, mm-hmm. about the university. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb was one. Caroline mm-hmm. Levine was another. Is that tension a big part of what you see, a big part of what you say kept you from getting things done, that tension between the university system and between the legislature, which seems
yes.
like is not resolved yet?
Yeah, definitely. And that's been one of the big challenges.
And what do you think is different? You're going to the UC Irvine. What will be different for you there?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, I think one thing that's I'm reminded of colleagues is that, the bureaucratic battles one fights at a university are always the same, and all state universities are going through some of the same challenges. I think for us, one thing is that because we sit at the intersection of technology and design and education, when you're trying to build new programs and kind of innovative new partnerships, it can be very difficult at a time when you don't have state support, again, where you have cutting funding and then you have less faculty autonomy than you ever have. One of our hopes is that in that milieu, with an established program, we might be able to spend a little less time trying to break down some of those bureaucratic walls.
And as far as the UW system, I know that Constance Steinkuller went to school here, got one of her degrees here.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some fondness there, I'm sure.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, but looking at that, so what are you going to miss? And what do you think are the challenges that remain for the UW system?
I'm going to miss WPR. I love WPR.
Uh-huh.
It's really a great asset. I think, there's a lot. I mean, I think the Wisconsin idea is a really powerful idea, and it's one that I hope that folks who are here building the university really stick with. And I think the other thing I'll say is that this is really an amazing world-class public public research university, and it's really rare to have such a world-class university across all areas, you know, everywhere from the med school to the vet school. I mean, it's just really kind of shocking when you hear it. And so I think one of the really great things is that that's not going to go away overnight, and I think that trying to build on that. And then again, one of my hopes is that being in the Midwest, something that in my own area that we can do is leverage the fact that Wisconsin has a high quality of life, that it is cheaper than the coast, that we can really build up a technology sector and scene that can rival the coast. So even though we're going, I think that that potential is still absolutely there.
I mean, people talk about that a lot, building up, you know, maybe it's Madison, maybe it's another small Midwestern town, but the potential to build up maybe a technology hub, maybe something else to rival the coast. Do you think that's realistic in real terms? Is it possible to do something big like that from the Midwest?
I actually think it is. I think that you're seeing other places also make similar investments. So New York has just invested in Rochester quite a bit. You know, Austin, which isn't the Midwest, but Austin is something that everyone points to. So I definitely think that it's here. I mean, we can already, you can point to the healthcare industry in places like Epic, and you can see, you know, what they've done. I think that there's a real potential as long as you get those sort of university state public partnerships together. And I'll say there's a group called Mad Rep in town that supports this kind of work, and they are really fabulous. And I hope that as we move on, we've worked with them closely, and as we move on, I hope some other faculty step up and really carry that on.
And as you prepare to move on, you're not there yet, but if you could wave your magic wand, what would you like to be different about the way the university system works with the legislature and works with its faculty?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I think one thing is that the sense of maybe of trust, and that people are mutually, you know, in this together, really trying to help, you know, benefit the state and do good research and teaching. And that's a part for the last couple of years that just feels like it's been missing for me.
We leave it there. Kurt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That was Kurt Squire. He's a professor of digital media and curriculum instruction at UW-Madison. And he joined us to talk about the future of the gaming industry in Wisconsin as he prepares to leave the UW-Madison for the University of California, Irvine.
Coming up, we'll hear from a resident of the Milwaukee neighborhood that saw protests this weekend and unrest after a fatal police shooting. He sees many parallels to unrest back in the 1960s that sprang from the era of segregation. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up today after 7, it's Latino USA. This week, tales of dealing with adversity. From a veteran who suffered severe burns to an Olympic athlete who didn't quite make the cut. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Right now, in 1967, President Lyndon Johnson established the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, known as the Kerner Commission. Its members were charged with examining the causes of urban violence and unrest, as well as recommending ways to improve racial relations in the nation.
Our next guest sees the parallels between the issues that the Kerner Commission was wrestling with nearly 50 years ago and the conditions in Milwaukee that contributed to the protests that and the unrest that broke out over the weekend. Reggie Jackson joins us now. He is a longtime resident of the Sherman Park neighborhood where the weekend's events played out. His Milwaukee Independent article on the subject called Evidence of Things Unknown is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Reggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you point out parallels between conditions in the 1960s that led to racial unrest and those that contributed to the events in Milwaukee over the weekend. What parallels do you see?
Well, a couple things to start with. Segregation, racial segregation, especially in bigger cities like Milwaukee, Detroit, Newark, New Jersey, Chicago, Los Angeles. Those were things that isolated the black community in all of those places. And of course, we know that Milwaukee is considered the most segregated city in the country. And in many respects, lots of the black residents of Milwaukee live in very segregated communities. Sherman Park is not exactly the most segregated part of Milwaukee. There are some white residents who live fairly close to where the park is. But the segregation does play a part. And the other big factor that relates to those times in the late 60s to today are the levels of unemployment within those communities, the dire prospects for people to find quality jobs. If we look at the unemployment rate, especially for younger people, 16 to 19, those rates are really, really extremely high in the black community in Milwaukee. And so a lot of the people that you saw contributing to this were young people. Many of them were probably unemployed. And so if we look at what the Kerner Commission talked about, it talked about economic conditions being a big factor. It talked about segregation being a big factor. And it also looked at 24 different riots that happened around the country, these civil unrest that happened in multiple cities. And the conclusion that they drew in terms of what precipitated those, they said that in about half of them, the last incident that kind of sparked everything, there were other incidents that kind of led up to it, but the one that typically sparked it, the last incident that happened before the unrest occurred, was police action. And so we saw that here in Milwaukee, as well as in Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, Maryland. A lot of the things that we've seen the past several years have mirrored those events that happened in the 1960s around the country.
So you're saying, according to that Kerner report, there may have been tensions and anxieties and issues filtering through the community for a long time, but that the final spark was a police action.
Yes, absolutely. If you live within the black community in Milwaukee, you know that the relationship between the police department and the black community has never been very strong. And this goes back decades to the time when Harold Breyer was the chief of police. The police had a horrible reputation, and their treating of black citizens very poorly led to a distrust of the police department. That's never really been overcome. We've had a variety of different police chiefs since then, but still the relationship between the black community and police still is not a good relationship. And if we look over the past several years at several high-profile cases, the killing of Dontre Hamilton in Red Arrow Park in 2014, we look at Derek Williams dying in the back of a squad car, not being assisted by those police officers, and several other incidents. These are things that stick out in the minds of black Milwaukee. We look back in the mid-90s, I believe it was, when Frank Jude was beaten by police officers on the south side of Milwaukee. We look at the cases of the officers from the district on Locust Street who were doing strip searches of black people in public, doing anal cavity searches of black people in public. And so there's a perception that's based on reality in the black community that the police do not respect black people, that they don't treat them the same as they treat people outside of our community. And so those conditions really were ripe for something to happen and lead to this type of unrest.
Now, some reports have come out that the police officer who shot Sylville Smith was African-American, and that Smith, also African-American, had a gun when he turned toward the officer while fleeing his car. Do those facts change anything for you?
I don't think that they really do. First of all, I have to say that the details of what happened on that particular day were not given to the public on the day that it happened. People didn't know the details of the encounter with the police officer, Mr. Smith. That didn't come out until the following day when Chief Flynn returned to town and kind of gave some of those details. And in terms of the officer being African-American, I think there's a perception that people believe African-American officers are viewed differently by the African-American community than white officers or Hispanic or Asian. But in reality, when you talk to people on the street, they'll tell you that they look at them all the same because they're all police officers. They all wear the same blue uniform. There's a consistent code of silence among police officers when they do things that they're not supposed to do. And so people in the community view them as all being the same, regardless of what racial group that they're attached to.
We're talking right now with Reggie Jackson, resident of the Sherman Park neighborhood, and he wrote a piece called Evidence of Things Unknown for the Milwaukee Independent, and that's linked right now on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about this incident in Milwaukee over the weekend when violence broke out as a reaction to the shooting death of Sylville Smith by Milwaukee police. And Reggie, you were saying it doesn't seem to matter if there are more African-American officers on the force. That's not something that might change the equation. What do you think would improve the relationship between communities of color and police officers?
Well, I actually do believe that it would make a difference if there were more police officers who were African-American on the police force, people that are familiar with those communities, that have ties to the community, that are able to really relate to the types of issues people in that community are dealing with. What I was saying earlier, though, is in terms of the perception of the officer who shot Mr. Smith, whether he was white or black, I don't think that that really makes a difference to most people in the community. All they know is that there was a police officer who shot a black man. They didn't get the details of the fact that Mr. Smith had a gun. But, you know, when you look at all of these cases around the country over the last, you know, 3 to 4 years, whether the person was armed or unarmed who died as a result of an encounter with the police, people within the black community, many of them, now there's a variety of different voices, a variety of different opinions, obviously, but many people will tell you that it's simply when they encounter the police, they see the police as a force within that community that's not necessarily there to protect and serve them because of how disrespectful the police are to so many people. And people always share those stories with other individuals. Now, one of the things I think that would make a huge difference, and this isn't just here in Milwaukee, but nationwide with police departments, a lot of people within the African American community would tell you this, that they don't feel the police are held to the same standards as regular citizens. If a police officer kills someone illegally versus a regular citizen killing someone illegally, they are not typically charged with the same offense. If you look at the case of Oscar Grant, who was killed by a Bay Area Rapid Transit officer in 2012, I believe, that officer obviously shot this young man in the back. He was unarmed. He was handcuffed. He didn't face a first-degree murder charge. And this is typically what happens. People feel that the police, even when it's proven that they murdered someone, that they're not charged with murder as a regular citizen would be. And so people have a perception that the police need to be treated the same as regular citizens when they do things that are illegal. And until that happens, people are not going to have a great deal of trust in the criminal justice system. People really don't understand that there was a Supreme Court case that is directly related to all of these police shootings. And in this case, I wish I could remember the name of it off the top of my head, but I can't. But in this case, it basically revolved around whether or not police officers had the right to use deadly force. And the Supreme Court ruled that as long as those officers felt that their lives were threatened in terms of physical bodily harm or imminent death to them or any civilians that were in the vicinity, then they had the right to use the greatest amount of force necessary, including deadly force. And as a result of that law, you find in case after case after case, the police officers who are accused of killing people, whether they're armed or unarmed, the response from the officer is always exactly the same, that person in that situation made me feel fear for my life. And it reminds me very clearly of the history of lynching in the United States of America. When you go back and look at the history of lynching, you'll find that the results of those investigations of lynchings were almost always the same in terms of what people said afterwards. It said that this person, even though there may have been a mob of 10, 15, 20,000 people there to witness it, they would say in the reports that this person died at the hands of persons unknown. So that's another parallel, is that we hear the same stories over and over again, and quite frankly, people within the African American community just don't believe that these versions are the truth. When we see the case of Michael Scott, who was shot in the back by a police officer in South Carolina, the official version, the police report that was written by those officers on the scene, lied and said that Mr. Scott had taken the taser from the officer. And had it not been for a civilian filming that, we would have never known the truth. The official version would have been the version had that civilian who took the video shadow of that had he not come forward. And so as a result of things like that and anecdotal stories that we hear within our community about police mistreating people, we find that there is a great deal of distrust, not only in the police, but in the district attorney's office and the entire apparatus that's related to charging police officers. So it really, unless we can reform the system and have the officers held accountable and responsible at the same level that we hold civilians, then I really think that there will continue to be a great deal of distrust of officers and the system.
We're talking with Reggie Jackson right now, who lives in the Sherman Park neighborhood of Milwaukee, where violence broke out this weekend as a reaction to the shooting death of Sylville Smith by Milwaukee police.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen firsthand the challenges, the tensions between African-American communities and police in Milwaukee and other parts of the state? Can you relate to the frustration that seems to be boiling up after this latest incident? Or do you feel there's never an excuse for property destruction and violence? Do you see a way forward for better relations between different racial groups in Milwaukee, in the state, in the nation, and between police and minority communities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page where you can read Reggie's article.
We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Reggie Jackson. He lives in the Sherman Park neighborhood of Milwaukee, where protests and unrest took place this weekend after a Milwaukee police officer shot and killed a man during a traffic stop.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How can racial disparities and racial differences in Milwaukee and the rest of the state be addressed? What responsibility do you think residents, community members, law enforcement, politicians have for creating meaningful change? Given the many issues that exist, what should be the top priority? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Reggie, I want to ask you, we spoke with Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor yesterday, and one of the things that she had said is that maybe some manner of civics education, civics lessons, would be helpful so that people knew how to protest, and I'm assuming protest peacefully. What do you think about that suggestion of hers?
Well, I think that's a great suggestion. I've spent quite a bit of time the last several days out in the community where these events have taken place, talking to people who are residents of the area, talking to people who've come in as part of the protest, and a couple things that I think need to be really made clear. If you look at what happened in terms of the looting, in terms of the businesses being burned, that was a small segment of people, many of them from outside the Sherman Park community. I talked to some young people who lived directly across the street from where the BP gas station was day before yesterday, who were actually out that night where the gas station was set on fire. And what they told me was that there was a small group of people from the community who'd gathered in that area, and in addition to that, there were people from other parts of the city who saw something on Facebook or Instagram or things of that nature who started to gather in the community. They told me that they saw people using their cell phones to invite other people to come and participate in what was going on at that particular time. And so what you saw was a kind of a festive atmosphere, people dancing, people singing, all of these different things before they began to damage the property. And so what the people in that community have told me in very clear terms is that they were not happy about the businesses that were lost. They were very upset that the gas station was burned. They were upset that the O'Reilly Auto Parts and the jewelry store, which was damaged, and the bank that was damaged, and the beauty supply store. They were very upset about that. I didn't hear a single person out of all of the people that I talked to, and I literally talked to dozens of people. I did not hear a single person who approved of those particular things happening. Now, when you look at the report that I wrote, one of the things I talked about was the impact of young people in these things that happened. Because when you see the video of the young people who are, damaging the gas station before it's set on fire, you see that that's a group of people that look like they're in their teens, or perhaps their early 20s. And one of the things I talked about is that people of that age, when they do things, they don't really understand necessarily the long-term consequences of what they do.
Are you talking about the brain science taking a while to catch up?
Yes, absolutely. Brain science tells us that the pre prefrontal cortex, which is the part of our brains that helps us to reason things out, helps us to make decisions about long-term consequences. That part isn't fully developed until the age of 25. So people make very foolish decisions at that age, and they don't understand the long-term consequences. And so
I'm going to jump in here so we can get to our callers. We have a lot of people waiting to talk to you, Reggie. And we're going to go first to Simi in Milwaukee. Hi, Simi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to comment. You know, I live in Sherman Park. I'm about 9 blocks from where they burnt down the gas station. 9 blocks, and maybe, you know, 3 blocks away from Burleigh. And I live on a segregated block or integrated block, maybe 30% are white. And we get along fabulously with our neighbors. We have no problems at all. Our neighbors help each other out when things go wrong, or there's damage done to a car or something. Everyone's out helping. The kids get along even well.
Simi, thanks for that. Describing a community feeling there that isn't segregated, that it is a black community, white community living in and working together. Well, what do you think about that portrayal of Sherman Park, Reggie?
That's absolutely the case. You know, it's an integrated community. There aren't a lot of whites there. There are a significant number of whites as compared to many other neighborhoods in the city. But when I was out that first morning after the unrest occurred, I was out very early that morning, driving around, talking to people, taking photographs of the damage. And one of the things that I saw immediately that morning, and I was out there for probably about 4 hours at least, from about 7 o'clock until about 11 that morning. And what I saw consistently were people from the community who were out there having discussions about what happened. But at the same time they were having those discussions, they were picking up trash. They had trash bags with them. They were passing out gloves for people to help pick up trash. They had brooms and they were sweeping. So everybody that I saw out there that morning, at the park, at the gas station, over by the O'Reilly Auto Parts, and all the places that were damaged, there were people from the community who were out there trying to reconcile by having conversations and actually cleaning up the community that they hold very dear to their hearts. So there was a balance of people, blacks as well as whites, who were out there that morning, people who care about the community, people who've, you know, in many cases lived in their community for an extended period of time.
Well, Simi, thank you for the call. And we go next to Andreas in Madison. Andreas, hi.
Oh, hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm very happy to hear somebody like Reggie. I don't know him, but I was going crazy trying to talk to you because he just hitting the nail on the head. We need so much change in the police force, not only Milwaukee or I'm myself from Madison, Wisconsin, but nationwide. And as you can tell, I have an accent and a minority. And also, I was trying to become a police officer a couple of years ago. I went to the police academy, and the idea, perception, the police officers always get the advantage of saying that they shoot somebody in defense. Always you have to stop the threat. And that definition was never explained to me. As much as I asked for that definition, they just tell you to stop the threat. And I think they abuse that, and that's why we have so much problem in the United States about that.
Andreas, thank you for that comment. And Reggie, there's about 30 seconds left here, but looking again at police reform, Andreas was getting at, and some of what you were talking about how to handle that threat and whether the police officer should be able to say, I felt threatened and therefore I shot. What do you think is needed, again, going forward in Milwaukee to repair that community?
Well, I think from the perspective of the police, they need to have more definitive and long-term training on implicit bias and the role that plays and how officers perceive people within the community. And in addition to that, just simple de-escalation training to de-escalate situations so they don't get to the point where there's a feeling of the officer fearing for his life. those things and also conversations with the community. I'm a member of the board for the Zeiler Center for Public Discussion, and we have been involved in having police community dialogues for the past several months, and those have really played an important role in bridging the gap between people in the community and the police department, as well as the work that I do as chairman of the board for America's Black Holocaust Museum, training people about racism and bias and all of these things and how they play a role in our society. It's imperative that we really learn more about the history of these things and look at the history of these events today in parallels to the events in the past and see them.
Reggie, thank you so much for your time. That was Reggie Jackson, resident of the Sherman Park neighborhood where the protests and unrest centered this weekend. His article is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.